Welcome to The Book Show. And coming up on this evening's show, we'll be talking to American writer Garth Greenwell about his debut novel, and we'll hear about a new Belfast literary journal, The Tangerine. But first, Virgil's story The Aeneid depicts the Trojan Wars, that infamous horse, and the love affair between Dido and Aeneas. T.S. Eliot said that it's a classic of all Europe, which we hope doesn't put the cast and crew of theatre company Collapsing Horse under too much pressure. They're preparing a stage version of Virgil's classic for this year's Tiger Dublin Fringe Festival. I went along to rehearsals to discuss the book and now the play with director Dan Colley, and I began by asking him how he first heard of this classic story.
I had a wonderful primary school teacher when I was in third class called Mrs. Seeley, and every Friday she would tell us a different episode in the story of the Odyssey, and I just fell in love with Greek and Roman mythology since then. And I later discovered the Aeneid, which is a kind of a Roman remix, basically, of the Greek myths.
If anybody doesn't know the story of the Aeneid, could you summarise it for us?
It is a epic story about a man who is a prince of Troy, but also the son of the goddess Venus, who wakes in the night to find that his city is on fire. Troy, and the Greeks, after 10 years, have finally taken their city, and he leads a small band of people across the Mediterranean Sea, destined to find a homeland for his people, and found Rome. And there's various obstacles in his way along the way, including falling in love with Dido, including having to take a trip to the underworld to find out what it is that's ahead of him for the Roman people.
Obviously, when you take an existing text, you want to put your own stamp on it. So what is Collapsing Horse's version of this story?
The thing we're really interested in is the context in which the Aeneid was written. I mean, as I said, it's a Roman remix of a Greek myth. It was commissioned by the Emperor Augustus to Virgil, and he said, write me a myth, write me the story of this country that we have founded. And he did. And we thought we'd really emphasise how this thing gets made. So we imagined a world in which the Aeneid was an oral tradition, that it was a theatrical tradition, and a world in which there are five people whose job it is exclusively to perform the Aeneid every year to keep the story alive and vibrant and orthodox. And this is a story about how one of them decides to take another track on it.
Ah, Aeneid, you're doing a fantastic job. Well done. You have the light of Aeneas in you, that is for sure.
Aeneid, just to mention, there were Trojans who were washed overboard and passed in the storm there. You need to actually translate their names, like Orentes, Alates, Abetes, because otherwise they might not get another mention and then their names be lost altogether.
Cato?
Okay. Achates.
Cato, I think Aeneid is doing superbly.
I do too, but we're not doing this to allow people to slip to their final death.
I am sure that in the translation itself, Aeneas will communicate those names to Aeneid and she will translate their story. If not, then that is the will of Aeneas.
Maeve O'Mahony, you're playing Aeneas in the play, which is a bit of a gender swap.
Yes, I'm playing Aeneas, who is then played by the character Aeneid, who I'm also playing. So we all play kind of double characters. We play the characters in the epic and then also our own actor, performer characters as well.
Virgil's poem is obviously written in 12 books, so how do you take something so formal and then break it open for a theatrical audience? And I'm guessing, obviously, you've got actors and you've got a lot of movement and textiles, props, puppetry, so let's have a look at some of those.
One moment that I think everyone recognises from the books is the Trojan horse, which is obviously something that you would need a huge budget and stage to even begin to try and accommodate for. So instead of trying to do that, we've turned that moment into a really miniature moment, and we're just going to have a tiny origami horse on a shield, as if the shield was like the sand outside the walls of Troy.
So this is the famous horse, albeit quite a diminutive version of it. It's made out of paper, it's origami, and it's on a sort of a gold shield. Is that a shield?
It is a shield, yeah. Also used as a shield in the play.
There was no sign of them, except for a big, huge, wooden horse. What could it be, they wondered? Perhaps it's a gift from the gods. No, said others, it's a trap. Still others said,
this is an offering. The Greeks must have made it for favorable winds. We should bring it in to our city and benefit from its blessing.
It's a blessing.
Dan, obviously we've been talking about props and puppetry and the design of what we visually see, but I am horrified as a book lover to see that there are pages and books strewn all about me on the floor. So what is this about? What part of the show is this? What does it symbolise?
I know, we're very irreverent about books here, I'm afraid. I shouldn't be talking to the book show at all about this. But the idea is that this is an old institution that these rhapsodes are in. It's thousands of years old. They've passed it on. And it's this sacred space that's somewhere between a library, an academy, and a theatre. So there are these piles of translations that other people have done over the years, and it's around them. So we use that as a symbol of the weight, I suppose, of tradition that they have here, to give a sense of the importance of what happens when one of the rhapsodes in this generation decides to part with that tradition, decides to tell a different story.
More recently, people would have maybe engaged with Seamus Heaney's version of Book 6, and this, along with your production, proves that people are still turning to the story, it still feels relevant. And why do you think that is?
There's a lot in it for anybody to see if they want to see it. Seamus Heaney saw his father in it. It was the story of the underworld to ultimately visit his father, and he wrote it after his father died. It's a grand narrative. It's got gods and the machinations of the fate. It's got enormous civilizations clashing against each other over land, but it's also got these intimate moments of human frailty and foibles and love. So against this enormous backdrop, there are these little human intimacies. So I think whatever it is that you want from a story, a lot of people turn to the Aeneid for it, and you won't necessarily see everything in the Aeneid on stage, but you will see what we've seen in it.
Thanks to Dan Colley and the rest of the Collapsing Horse team for that. And the music you heard in that piece was composed for the show by Tom Lane and Daniel Ford. The production of the Aeneid will be at Smock Alley Theatre in Dublin from September 14th to the 24th. The website is fringefest.com. Now, we're off to the Seamus Heaney Centre for Poetry at Queen's University in Belfast to meet the editors of a new literary journal, The Tangerine. Last week, their submissions round closed for their first edition, and before they got stuck into the long process of reading through them all, they took time to talk to Regan Hutchins about their new journal and began by explaining how they came up with the name.
Tangerine.
Hello, I'm Michael Nolan. I'm the fiction editor. We went for the Tangerine because we thought it was a very citrusy, bright, flavourful name. And I guess that's the kind of attitude we want to take towards this, you know. We want to go and find things that are colourful and different and things that sort of push the boundaries of what is traditional or whatnot. It came from a Louis MacNeice poem, I know that. I can't remember what the poem is or what the quote is, but I know that's where it came from.
I'm Caitlin Newby. I am the poetry editor of The Tangerine. The poem that it comes from is Snow by Louis MacNeice. I peel and portion a tangerine and spit the pips and feel the drunkenness of things being various.
I suppose really we're interested in the heritage of political writing here in magazines like The Honest Ulsterman and Fortnight.
That's Tara McAvoy, the editor of The Tangerine. Her mission is to build on the current boom in Northern Irish writing and to offer something more.
Really, we'd hope to offer a platform to new voices and voices that are perhaps left out of conversations here. So we'd be very interested in reflecting, for example, the experiences of people who have come to Belfast from other places, from women, members of the LGBT community, people of colour and people with disabilities.
I would say that there's a feeling in Northern Ireland and in Belfast that you do either have to go south the border across the water to get something published. For a new writer starting out and trying to find places to get something published, that sort of puts you at a remove almost straight away at the very beginning of your career. Everything seems to be elsewhere.
Jan Carson is a Belfast-based writer. She's the author of a novel called Malcolm Orange Disappears and a collection of short stories, Children's Children. She points to the need for new Northern Irish journals such as The Tangerine.
there really are very few opportunities for Northern Irish writers to be acknowledged in our own place. There's fantastic opportunities for readings and particularly for poetry readings, but in terms of prose, we're down to just having a couple of small presses left and no print journals really, apart from maybe the Irish Pages, and I honestly can't think of another one. So I'm proud to be a writer from Northern Ireland, and I'd like to see that reflected in the work that comes out of here. One of the biggest things that happened to Northern Ireland, and I'm a little bit older than these guys, but in my time here was the arrival of EasyJet, because it's become so much easier to get to other places in Europe, and people do travel a lot more and bring back the influences in terms of art and culture, and this has become much more of a mixing pot of cultural influences in the last 5 years, 10 years definitely. So I think that obviously begins to impact the art that comes out of a place. But the troubles are still there. They're still hanging around in the background. And to me, that makes actually a really interesting backdrop to create art and literature against. In a sense, people are quite bored with the Northern Irish story. And so they're expecting the old kind of art that's just troubles front and central. And what these guys are doing is very interesting in that they're giving a space for something new. I'm just not sure that it has been reflected elsewhere.
For poetry editor Caitlin Newby, the fact that she's not from Northern Ireland guides her in her search for new voices.
I am open to hearing voices from people who are living in Belfast or the north of Ireland who aren't originally from here, from people from the north who have moved elsewhere, how they see the world now, how they see Belfast and the north of Ireland now.
She cites Stephen Sexton as an example of a fresh voice in poetry and reads his poem called Humour.
It's nothing, he would say, crying at the burger joint. Not the malt in the milkshakes, nor the tint of iron in the beef. Not mercury in retrograde, not the office job, not the price of gold or crude, not Cheryl receding lately into herself like a little sailboat unmoored drifting on the great moony sea. In wet yellow Macintoshes, kids arrive like emissaries and the future keeps happening to them. And it's true there was nothing, as far as he could tell, that had him cry in the burger joint. Nevertheless, tears fell in his lap, mysterious and many, as the sesame seeds dashed in the bun of his cheeseburger.
In 2015, Jan Carson set about a new writing project. Every day, she would write a postcard and send it to someone she knows. She sent 365 in total, and here's her postcard from October 7th.
You were born with a bird's egg grasped firmly in your right hand. It wasn't big enough to be a chicken's. It was pale blue with freckles like the eggs you sometimes come across in woodland nests. You don't remember being born with a bird's egg in your fist or how it got there, why it hadn't cracked under the pressure of your fingers or the force of being born. It is a mystery to you, like breathing or knowing a thing you have not been told. After you were born, they took the bird's egg out of your hand and kept it for days under a heat lamp, but it did not hatch. Eventually they opened it, cracked its thin shell against a spoon and tipped it, yolk and all, into a teacup. There was a little dot like the red of an eye in photographs. It was swimming in the yolk. It looked up at them and did not blink. Why would it? So there you newly were, with an egg in your hand, with an eye in this egg, like a set of Russian dolls, or how we all are, secretly, inside.
As well as being a playful exercise, the postcard project ties in with something the Tangerine itself is committed to.
The role of magazines and journals is to nurture new talent, I think, first and foremost. And I think that's one of our main priorities, is to get these writers and give them a platform to see their work in print and to guide them.
It gives people something to hold on to and to cherish. A physical object.
To be really honest, I prefer print writing. I love objects. I love real, tangible things. And I'm sitting here in a room full of absolutely beautiful books, and my eye can't keep away from them. And
I really, truly believe that people still love objects. When I did the postcard stories, I actually sent physical postcards to people, and the response which came back, even folks producing their own art and sending it back, was really overwhelming. People like to curate and own and hold on to things, and you just can't do that with something online.
You can keep an eye on The Tangerine online at thetangerinemagazine.com, and you can follow them on Twitter at thetangerinemag. Finally tonight, Garth Greenwell is the author of a debut novel called What Belongs to You. It tells the story of an unnamed narrator, I, who is an American teacher living in Bulgaria. Like his narrator, Greenwell is originally from Kentucky and has taught for a number of years in Bulgaria. The narrator embarks on an affair with a Bulgarian hustler he meets in a public toilet. Garth Greenwell joined us recently in studio to discuss his book, and he began with a short reading from the start of the novel, where the narrator first makes contact with the hustler, Mitko.
He was tall, thin but broad-shouldered, with the close-cropped military cut of hair popular among certain young men in Sofia, who affect a hyper-masculine style and an air of criminality. He greeted me with an elaborate rush of words at which I could only shake my head in bemusement as I grasped the large hand he held out, offering as broken apology and defense the few phrases I had practiced to numbness. His smile widened when he realized I was a foreigner, revealing a chipped front tooth, the jagged seam of which, I would learn, he worried obsessively with his index finger in moments of abstraction. Even at arm's length, I could smell the alcohol that emanated not so much from his breath as from his clothes and hair.
Garth, the character of Mitko began life in a novella of the same name that you wrote a few years ago. And in this novel, you developed the character more fully. So why did you go back to him in this book?
You know, it was a surprise to me. You know, I wrote each section of the book kind of separately. And it wasn't until I began writing the third section that, you know, this character just kind of insisted to come back and continue that story. It really did feel like something I didn't entirely choose.
He's the only named character in the book, and the character is a first-person narrative, and we only hear from I. So was it deliberate to not name the person who's telling us this story?
You know, it really was. And in the very first scene when the narrator meets Mitko, he descends into this subterranean space, and there's something kind of initiatory about that. And when he meets Mitko and they introduce each other, it turns out that the narrator's name is unpronounceable. Mitko can't pronounce it. There's sort of sounds that Bulgarian doesn't have. And that felt very important, that at the beginning of the book, this character is stripped of his name. I think that opens up possibilities for him, that he sort of loses something at the start.
What kind of possibilities does that offer? And is that, I suppose, one of the joys of writing a novel, and that you don't always know where it's going to go?
Absolutely. And that really was the experience of writing this book. I mean, I'd never written fiction before, and I did feel like I was sort of discovering the book sentence by sentence. And, you know, this character, I think he's a very strange character in some ways, because, you know, he keeps kind of telling the reader that he's telling us everything, and he's kind of confessing his deepest secrets. And yet there's another way in which he's very defended and sort of protective of himself and kind of not letting us in. He's forced to speak a language he doesn't speak well. And this is a narrator, you know, he's a poet. And the way he uses language is sometimes a kind of defense. You know, he feels like he has a kind of mastery of language. And the relationship with Mitko takes that away from him. I mean, in Bulgarian, he has to speak like a child. It makes him vulnerable in a way that I think he hasn't been before.
Mitko is a hustler of sorts, and his relationship with the narrator sort of bleeds into one of friendship, and there is sort of money exchanging, whether that's for sex or for transport. And I'm wondering, how does the transactional start of their relationship have an impact on it in the long term?
I think it absolutely shapes the relationship. I think it forms the relationship. I think it deforms the relationship. Their relationship is determined to some degree by the transaction with which it begins, and yet, you know, because this is a face-to-face encounter between two human beings who remain fully human beings at every point of their interaction, I think there is always the possibility of feeling between them that overflows the bounds of that transaction. And so I don't think it's true that in the book they ever kind of get past the transactional nature of the relationship. But I also, you know, there's a moment, or there are a couple of moments in the book where Mitko says to the narrator, he says, "You are an istinski prijatel, you are a true friend." And I hope that there's a way in which that's true. I think of the book as a love story. I think it is a strained and a strange love story.
It's also set in Bulgaria, and you live there for a time teaching an American high school there, just as your narrator is a teacher. It also goes back to the narrator's childhood. It moves around a little, and his difficult relationship with his own father. His father kicks him out for being gay, and you portray sort of homophobia in 1980s Kentucky really well, frighteningly so. How much autobiography is in this novel?
You know, the novel throughout plays with autobiography. I've spoken pretty candidly about the fact that that middle section does cut very close to the bone. I think that's why it was the most difficult section to write, because in some way, ending up in Bulgaria was kind of the end of a long process, really, of kind of running away from my childhood. I mean, I hadn't been to Kentucky for well over a decade. And what was most surprising about Bulgaria was that even though I was in a place that felt so strange, I had this experience again and again of being reminded of the Kentucky I grew up in. And as I spoke with my students who were gay, because I was teaching at a high school in Bulgaria, and I was the only openly gay person in the school community. I was the only openly gay person almost any of my students had ever met. And that meant that students who thought they might be queer came to speak to me. And for all of the differences between Bulgaria in, you know, the 20-teens and Kentucky in the late 80s and early 90s, I felt that they were telling me my own story. They spoke about their lives in a way that suggested that they had exactly the same horizon of possibility drawn across them as the first gay men I met in Kentucky in the early 90s. And that's really what the book comes from, you know, wanting to write about gay people and the kinds of communities they form in places where gay people are taught a single lesson about their lives, which is that their lives lack value and their lives lack dignity.
When we think of gay writers alive today, we might think of people like Edmund White or Allan Hollinghurst or even our own Colm Tobin. So from the 70s, which was the so-called golden age, through to the AIDS crisis, they represent late 20th century gay literature. And your book has been hailed as a great gay novel. So how do you feel that gay writing has responded to this century and to things like marriage equality and even the post-gay era?
I do identify as a gay writer, and it does feel important to me that I'm writing in a tradition of gay and of queer writers. And I think there is a continuity between my book and between, you know, those great books of the past, books that when I was a teenager in Kentucky, you know, I feel very strongly did save my life. I mean, when I found Edmund White's A Boy's Own Story and James Baldwin's Giovanni's Room, they gave me a vision of gay life that had dignity, you know, and that was the antidote to the only vision of gay life I had in the place where I grew up, which was one of humiliation and illness and death. Something that interests me about this moment in queer history is that someone like my narrator, for decades he has been steeped in the language and the arguments of gay activism, and he knows that the lessons he was taught about his life as a child are utterly bankrupt. He rejects them. He doesn't believe them. And yet he will never get to be a person who was not shaped by those lessons. And so that particular moment we're in, where we are the people we are because of a shame we have rejected, that's what I wanted to explore, that moment of queer consciousness, which is not the same as, say, James Baldwin's David in Giovanni's Room, who, you know, is desperate to be straight, is desperate to try to understand why he's gay, you know, feels like his life is tragically doomed because he's gay. My narrator feels none of that. But I think shame is still part of the burden gay people carry. And I think we need to be able to talk about that.
Have you gone back to Kentucky? Do you couldn't care less for it? Do you want to go back? Is there a part of you curious about going back? Or are you thinking, no, that's the past?
You know, I went back for the first time in a very long time, May a year ago, because my youngest sister got married. And then I went back again in February to read from the book. And I was in Kentucky for about 10 days. It was amazing to me how much the place has changed, how kind of profound my response to it was. I mean, my whole life I've moved every 2 years, you know, and to go somewhere and to remember, oh, you know, I remember that building my father took me there when I was 5, you know, that was a kind of response. I was surprised by the intensity of my response. And I was surprised, you know, I expected to sort of have bad feelings, you know, and to remember how hard life was there. And I did. I didn't expect to remember how wonderful it is. And of course, it's a very different place now for queer people than it was when I left. And it's very heartening to see. I think a teenager growing up in Louisville, Kentucky today has a very different experience from what I had 25 years ago.
And thanks there to Garth Greenwell. His novel, What Belongs to You, is published by Picador. Now, next week, we're coming to you from Dublin Castle for Culture Night, and we'll be hearing from Ireland's top crime writers, as well as listening to a very special recital from Crash Ensemble. If you want to come along to any of the events on Culture Night, check out culturenight.ie, as thousands of galleries and cultural institutions are open with loads of events taking place around the country. But that's all we've time for this evening. Follow us on Twitter at BookshowRTE, and thanks to producer Regan Hutchins and series producer Zoe Cummins.